In the old Peanuts comic strip, the character called Pigpen was this really messy little kid, constantly surrounded by a dust and debris cloud of his own making. It's a little like the space around our Earth, which is orbited by ever-growing volumes of space junk. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's already so much whizzing around the planet that some astronomical observatories are finding their peeks into deep space occluded by human-made objects. And if we can't get a handle on it, our own planetary Pigpen cloud could render low Earth orbit unusable. Jamie Green is the series editor of the best American science and nature writing and author of The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Her article about space junk is titled Befouling the Final Frontier and appears in the New York Times Magazine. Jamie, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, orbiting spacecraft obviously don't last forever, no matter how they're maintained. What will happen when the International Space Station's mission is complete in 2030?
To put it simply, the ISS will be nudged out of its orbit, and eventually it will crash into the ocean.
How can they be sure it will go into the ocean?
With a lot of calculations and double checking. Basically, so normally the ISS needs periodical nudges upwards to stay in orbit, because even though it's in space, it's in the upper reaches of Earth's atmosphere. So there is a little bit of drag that slows the space station down and would pull it down and down and down into orbit until it crashed. But come 2029 or so, they're going to do a few of those careful nudges downward to bring the space station into lower orbit. And then when no one's on board, a big nudge is going to send it on a carefully plotted trajectory into the spot in the Pacific Ocean that is farthest away from land entirely.
Of course, crashing things into the oceans, I mean, you can do that. You can do it a few times. I mean, arguably, if we do that every time something doesn't work anymore, we're going to mess up the oceans.
Well, it is how most space missions end nowadays to human spaceflight. Like when we had the space shuttle, those could land like airplanes on a runway. But now, just like it was with the Apollo astronauts coming from the moon, there's a capsule that crashes into the ocean and a boat comes out to meet the astronauts and tows it back on board. So it's actually not a terrible environmental issue, because nothing's getting left behind in the ocean. The debris or the capsules are collected.
Okay.
But it's a safe way to bring people back as well.
And I don't want to get too hung up on this, but those careful nudges that you described, are those done with something physical in space, or is there some kind of power mechanism on board that can be reset and move the ISS into the proper location?
I'm not up on the specifics of it, but I believe that it is little sort of boosters on the ISS, because actually most large satellites nowadays also have their own little propulsion systems to give them a nudge this way or that to avoid collisions, which, as I'm sure we'll get to, are a major problem or threat in orbit.
So the ISS, Jamie, has been in low Earth orbit, at least in proto form, since 1998. It's been built up since then. But before we get too far into this, can you remind us of what counts as low Earth orbit?
Yeah, so low Earth orbit is a few hundred miles above the surface of the Earth. It is, you know, the bottom edge of space. There are sort of orbital shells, I like to think about them as, that sort of surround the Earth. And the farther out you go, the slower the satellites or things go. So like, but lots of communication satellites, telecoms, Earth observation, and the space stations are in low Earth orbit, pretty close to the Earth.
And what do we need to understand about the difference between how low Earth orbit satellites behave and the activity of what are called geosynchronous satellites that sit something like 22,000 miles above the planet?
It's less about the individual satellites and more about the number of them. It's if you think about it, kind of makes sense that it's easier to get satellites to low Earth orbit because there's not as far that the rocket launching them has to go. Although once they're in orbit, satellites in low Earth orbit are moving much faster than satellites higher up. The reason that a satellite in geosynchronous orbit, the name means that it is synchronized with the spin of the Earth. So it is also sometimes called geostationary orbit, where the satellite stays above the same spot of the on the Earth and sort of makes one orbit every 24 hours. Whereas lower down, they're moving a lot faster. And we're talking about, you know, dozens of minutes rather than two dozen hours. So low Earth orbit is more crowded. And also the satellites there are moving much faster.
Yeah, low Earth orbit is more crowded and has become ever more so. That space a couple of hundred miles above the planet has changed since the ISS first went up, almost like building a house in a remote area that blooms into a bustling suburb over a couple of decades. Talk a little bit about how the neighborhood of low Earth orbit has changed in the last 25 years.
Yeah, this blew me away when I was researching the piece, to the point that I emailed the scientist who I'd been talking to about all of this information. He keeps like this vast archive of every object that's been launched into orbit. And he has a website with a bunch of different charts and data tables. And so I got, you know, the 1998 information from one table and the current information from another table. And I emailed him and I said, Jonathan, this can't be right. There can't be more than 10 times more satellites now than there were in 1998. And he said, no, yeah, that's it. More than a tenfold increase in the number of satellites in orbit overall. And most of that is in low Earth orbit. So, when the ISS was launched, there were 200 satellites in low Earth orbit. And now there are something like 7,000 or 8,000, 5,000 of which alone, give or take, are Starlink, just from one company. It is really, it is way faster than anyone could build houses on a remote mountainside.
Starlink, that is Elon Musk's company, right?
Yeah.
So back in, you know, 25 years ago, most of those early satellites were government owned and primarily only owned by the U.S. and Russia. What were those early satellites doing?
I'm sure a lot of them were doing secret things that no one really knows about now, because a good chunk of them were military. You know, there's lots of great spying to be done from orbit, but there was also a lot of non-military government work, weather satellites, observations. So much science can be done by observing the planet from orbit. And, you know, we also can observe outwards. Hubble Space Telescope is in orbit around the Earth. And luckily, because otherwise, if it was far away, like the James Webb Space Telescope, we wouldn't have been able to service it when it was launched and we discovered that all the images were blurry. So governments were using orbital space for satellites, you know, aside from the military stuff and the spy stuff, a lot like many companies and research institutions do now, to just gain knowledge from this exciting new vantage point from which we had never before been able to see the Earth.
You note that this explosive growth in the number of commercial satellites is actually a sign that the ISS has achieved one of its most important goals, the promotion of space activity by private entities rather than governments alone.
Yeah, when I learned that the ISS was being decommissioned to make way for commercial space platforms, commercial space stations, I was like, ooh, I don't like the sound of that. You know, I have this idealism about NASA and I don't want space becoming commercialized. But what I realized was the end of the era of the ISS means that that low Earth orbit and maybe Earth orbit in general are no longer the cutting edge of science. We've learned how to do orbit. It's become kind of mundane. And so it's not cutting edge. It's not where, you know, the government has so much power to fund science and push the limits of discovery. And they have pushed those limits past orbit.
So space has been broadly commercialized, other than letting us watch TV from lots of different places. I mean, what are entrepreneurs doing there?
it is a lot of, you know, telecommunications, international phone calls, ATM transactions are being bopped around through space, GPS, which has become such a consumer technology over the last couple of decades. There's also a lot of research and development being done in space, and not just for further space exploration, which was another one of the stated goals of the ISS, was to do research that would make other space exploration possible. But some substances and materials just work differently in zero gravity, like proteins fold differently. So drug discovery can be done in orbit, and you can discover things that you couldn't on Earth, for example. So also like manufacturing, research, things like that.
So this business has boomed, but putting a lot of objects into space means a fair amount of traffic in the sky, right? What are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, it's exactly like driving a car on Earth. When on Earth, as if you would drive a car somewhere else. When roads are narrow, the speed limit needs to be lower, because in order to safely drive at high speeds, you need a little more room for reaction time, for small errors, you know? And so then when you are going thousands and thousands and thousands of miles per hour, you need much wider lanes. And collisions, just like a car crash on Earth, if you're going 30 miles an hour versus 60 miles an hour, that's a very different level of force. You know, multiply that by thousands, and it really is dangerous. And then there, other than on the ISS or the Chinese space station, you don't generally have human bodies. So we're not like worried about people getting hurt, but the risk of collision, when there's a car crash on a highway, you can clean that up. When there's a car crash in space, or a satellite crash in space, I don't know why I keep talking about space cars. We are not there yet. The debris also goes into orbit. And so then each piece of debris still going at these fast speeds, now shooting off in all directions and not necessarily being tracked, especially if they're small, by agencies on Earth, each new piece of debris creates the threat of more collisions. So there's a real fear of a very dangerous domino effect as well.
And we should remind folks that, you know, those commercial satellites in low Earth orbit, a lot of them are quite small, right? I think I read somewhere that the Starlink satellites are like the size of a couch that might be in your living room. It's not like these are gigantic armored things that are designed to withstand a lot of impact.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, the goal is no impact. No, nothing in space is like hoping for impact and ready for it. You know, the ISS is shielded against, like, you know, bits of dust. But, you know, the size of a couch is not that far from the size of a small car, which is another way that I've heard Starlink satellites described. So those are actually not on the huge side for satellites, but those are substantial. Small satellites are more like suitcase sized. But even still, when you're going 17,000 miles an hour, I don't want to get hit by a suitcase doing that either.
So just so we're all clear here, Jamie, these low Earth orbit satellites can and do cross each other's path, right? It's not like everybody gets a dedicated route that belongs only to them. Is there anything like the air traffic control system that planes have to keep satellites from colliding?
There is now, and that is right. The paths do collide. And I actually, this was something I had trouble visualizing when I was writing the piece, because I was imagining parallel lanes. But since we're not talking about one strip of road, but a whole sphere, it's sort of like imagine a rubber band ball where you have all the circles at different angles and inclinations. And so they cross at many different points. There has been one major collision. I believe it was in 2009 between an active American telecommunications satellite from the company Iridium and a defunct Russian or Soviet satellite. And this was a real wake-up call for the industry, because this was before satellites tended to have propulsion systems on board. And it, you know, when space wasn't that crowded, it wasn't a big issue. But after that, there was a bit of a turnaround, and U.S. the U.S. government sort of took on the role of what I call space traffic control. It was a Space Force project for a while. I think it's being shifted to Department of Commerce, but the details don't matter. Basically, they are tracking all of these objects in orbit. And when they see they can project out a potential collision or close call, they literally email the owners of the satellites and say, hey, I think you need to adjust this way or that way. And this is another challenge to the rapid proliferation of satellites, where now it's not just like four government agencies who you have to have on speed dial. There are so many companies, universities, it's so much easier to launch a satellite. There are actually launch offerings called rideshares, where you just sort of buy space on a rocket for your satellite and they get it up there for you. But it just makes it even that much harder to figure out who owns a satellite, how do you get in touch with them, and what do you need to warn them about?
So am I understanding you correctly, Jamie, that the traditional practice, and I say traditional even though it's only been a few decades, the traditional practice with a satellite in low Earth orbit when it stops working or fulfills its mission and is no longer needed, it just gets left up there?
A lot of the time, yeah. It's sort of impossible to go get them. Like, we don't have like a big, like, you know, butterfly net where you can just scoop them out. And they're moving so fast. Like, how would you catch that? Right. One of the advantages to low Earth orbit is because it is so close to the Earth and it's in the very upper atmosphere, because there is drag, especially in the lower areas of low Earth orbit, the lower realms, satellites do eventually get pulled out of orbit and they burn up in the atmosphere for the most part. So this is the eventual fate of all the Starlink satellites. They're in the lowest shell of low Earth orbit. So luckily they won't be up there forever, but there is a lot of defunct machinery in orbit still. And not only would it be prohibitively expensive and difficult to get it, there is actually an argument for keeping it up there as a kind of archaeological record.
Hmm. Does stuff just fall off satellites ever? I mean, like, do parts break?
Ideally, no, but it could. I mean, there are definitely paint chips among the space dust in orbit. And we can't really track anything super small. So something that's like an inch or a centimeter big, we don't even know what's up there. From a collision with a piece of dust, it, you know, chips some paint off the ISS. Now that's another piece of dust. In addition to all of these satellites and defunct machinery and garbage, you know, that has been sort of like shot out the door of the ISS or whatever, rocket stages. So you know how rockets launch with like the big canisters and then that breaks off and the little top of the rocket keeps going. Those rocket stages often fall back to Earth into the ocean, burn up in the atmosphere, but sometimes they stay in orbit. So there's a lot up there.
I mean, we should note here that, you know, videos from space give the impression, I think, that stuff is just placidly drifting above our beautiful planet. It's moving, as you said, at 17,500 miles per hour. So even just the tiniest thing, even a paint chip at that speed is going to do some damage.
Yeah, I don't want to run into that, me or a satellite.
So you mentioned this scientist who is, I guess, has made kind of a sideline of tracking all the stuff that's out there. Is anybody doing this officially at this point?
No. And well, sort of. So this scientist, Jonathan McDowell, he's an astronomer who studies black holes. But ever since he was like 8 years old, he's had this hobby that has turned into a remarkable archive of keeping a record of all of the objects that have been launched into space. Because as he put it to me, space historians are mostly looking at the human stories, the decisions. He's looking at the objects, the trajectories. And so he has this tremendous archive of every satellite launch, everything that's up there, the trajectories, the paths, all of that. And it is unofficial. It's like in binders and computer files in his home. So if anyone out there is listening and like works for Google and wants to come digitize his archive, I think it's like a tremendous resource for humanity, not only for, you know, reporters like me. Otherwise, you know, when you ask about tracking, there is the sort of space traffic control kind of tracking of looking at the trajectories of objects, but there is not an official archive the way that Jonathan is keeping it, because no one sort of thinks to do that. You know, a project shuts down, a company shuts down, their files just go in the trash. He has told me he literally has dumpster dived to get records of launches and trajectories because no one else is saving this information, which is both historically important, and a lot of this stuff is still up in the sky. And so it's important today practically as well.
So I just want to make sure that we're clear on this. You mentioned nobody is really trying to make satellites more resistant to the potential damage of an unexpected strike by space debris. That's because it's functionally impossible to give them that much protection?
I don't know. I mean, the engineering of satellites is not something that I'm super up on. I'm sure that there are considerations about, like, structural integrity and being able to withstand, especially the micro collisions from dust and those flecks of paint that are kicking around. But the goal is definitely to avoid major collisions rather than to withstand them.
And no one has found a way to collect space junk flying around there, even space junk of a particular size, and somehow corral it so it doesn't pose a hazard to active satellites. Could it be pushed out farther from orbit?
It probably could, but I don't think that the space junk, the defunct satellites, are the biggest threat. You know, there are about 5,000 Starlink satellites. That is definitely more than there are defunct satellites. So the problem isn't the old material. The problem is that we are continuing to add new material.
Yeah, I think the estimate is that Starlink currently has like 6,500 satellites orbiting the Earth, and intends to have 30 or 40,000 in the next few years.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to keep up with because they're launching them like 50 or 60 at a time. And because they are a private company and a particularly secretive one at that, it can be hard to track. You know, you do have to announce what you're launching. The FCC controls that, but there's not a ton of regulation. And I think that is a much bigger threat to orbit than old defunct satellites.
And by international agreement, nobody is really allowed to claim ownership of territory in space. But I guess companies like Starlink, what they have is first mover advantage, right? They just put all their stuff out there and maybe that crowds out other options, maybe not. But no one is limiting the number of things they put up.
Correct. The FCC in the U.S. has authority over that because they have authority over broadcast, and satellites are technically broadcasting, but like the regulatory systems have absolutely not kept up with the technology. And I feel like companies like Starlink are taking advantage of that. And they say, okay, well, you guys figure that out at your slow bureaucratic pace. We're going to launch a few dozen thousand satellites. You know, it's the real, one of the real dangers of the move fast and break things philosophy of startups, because they're moving fast with their satellites and they are potentially breaking orbit for everyone.
One thing that I think is so interesting is what we learn from our own mistakes. I know that people who are looking for evidence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe have come to realize maybe we look for planets or other celestial bodies with their own clouds of space junk.
Yeah, those have been searches for right now, at least, you know, at the sort of scale or resolution that we would be able to detect things. We're able to look for much bigger structures. So that would be material around a star or around many of the stars in a galaxy. We don't yet have the fine enough vision with telescopes and other detection methods to see if someone else has a bunch of junk in their low planet orbit. But the idea of looking for defunct technology as evidence of a technological civilization is definitely a big one in the search for alien life.
Aside from collision hazards, how is the amount of traffic in low Earth orbit causing headaches for Earth-based space observation?
Yeah, this is another big one. Satellites are reflective. They shine when you see them. And if you've ever seen one at night in the night sky, it's actually really beautiful. I've seen the ISS. You can see them with the naked eye. I mean, not all satellites, but many of them. And they look like a star, a point of light that is just moving sort of uncannily smoothly across the sky. It's not a shooting star. It's not that fast, but it's not blinking like an airplane. It's really cool. But then when you have 6,000 of those, you're just increasing the number of moving lights in the sky that are not what astronomers are looking for. Starlight satellites often move in trains that are like little trains of, I don't know, 5 or 10 satellites. And that's weird for a stargazer to see. It's a big problem for an astronomer because every time a satellite crosses their field of vision through the telescope, it messes up their data, it messes up their observations. To a certain extent, you can edit that out, but it makes all of that work much more expensive and time consuming. And then even if the satellite doesn't cross directly in front of the telescope, having all of that shiny reflective material in orbit creates just a sort of glow. It scatters more ambient light and is, in general, even when there's not a satellite right in front of you, making the night sky a little lighter and a little lighter.
Yeah, when I think about the problem that earthbound observatories are having, I thought about, you know, using binoculars to see something that's, you know, 500 yards away. If somebody standing near you puts just a finger in front of those binoculars,
yeah,
you can't really see anything, even though a finger is tiny and what you're looking at is enormous.
Absolutely. They're so much closer and so much brighter than the distant objects that astronomers are looking at that it is already creating problems. This isn't just a future prediction, but it's getting worse and worse.
And what is the issue about radio signals affecting what observatories are trying to understand?
Yeah, I mean, so radio signals are another wavelength of light, of electromagnetic radiation. They're just not visible. And so satellites may be using that for communications. They may be bouncing and scattering radio waves as well. And a lot of important astronomy work is done through observing in radio, because radio waves can go through dust. Like, dust is opaque in visible light, but it's transparent to radio waves. And so radio astronomers are also running into the same sorts of challenges where these satellites are getting in the way.
Is there anything observatories are learning to do to minimize the effect of having their view into deep space obscured by objects so close to the planet?
I mean, you can use various kinds of noise filtering or data processing technologies to it's sort of like photoshopping red eye out of a picture. You know, you can still deduce what's out there, but it takes time, it takes money, it takes computer processing, which makes the research more expensive and more arduous, and it just slows the process down. But eventually, like, if you're just waving too many fingers in front of my binoculars, I can't see.
Do satellite operators, are they required to be able to communicate with one another? Does Starlink need to be able to tell someone else that there might be a collision imminent?
I don't think there are any requirements for that. I think for the most part, the satellite operators are relying on U.S. government agencies to be tracking things, because Starlink, if they wanted to see who they might be colliding with, they would sort of have to be tracking everyone else's trajectories anyway. So it does make sense for that to be centralized and not have everyone repeating all of the same work.
It does seem strange, Jamie. I mean, we think of space science as so precise and highly evolved. It just sounds like a kind of a wild west above the planet that no one has thought about in advance.
Yeah, absolutely. This was not planned. This was, ooh, satellites are cool. Oh, maybe I can use some satellites. And up it went. It's again, like, the lack of regulation. And that's because regulation moves slowly. Businesses move more quickly than governments, and their concerns are different. Their concerns are not the preservation of orbit as a resource for all of Earth now and in the future to be able to use. Their concerns are profit, and they see an opportunity to make profit and they go after it. And especially, you know, in America right now, the inclination is not towards regulation at the expense of profit, even if that would preserve a lot of benefits for future generations.
So in other words, we sort of leave this up to the ethics of the company launching those satellites, and that is not necessarily something we can rely on.
Yeah, no, I don't think that relying on a corporation's ethics is ever a way to end up somewhere good.
Jamie, the real hazard that scientists are starting to talk about is something called the Kessler effect. What does that term refer to?
So that is the idea that we may hit a point, and some people actually think we're at the beginning of it now, where there is so much debris in space, whether that is satellites or pieces of satellites or junk or whatever, that the collisions cascade. And one collision puts off thousands of pieces of debris. That debris is now in orbit and leads to other collisions. And so you may get to the point where, as one scientist put it to me, you can't send up new satellites and expect them to function if they're always flying through a field of bullets. So orbit, in effect, becomes unusable.
I mean, that would be bad for all the businesses that are making money doing things in space in low Earth orbit. But it's also, I mean, the sort of knock-on effects of space becoming unusable and destructive to pretty much everything we put up there, that could do a number on the kind of instant communication that we've all come to rely on.
Yeah, I mean, GPS, ATMs, international calling, satellite TV, like some of that work could be shifted to other realms of orbit. But our weather satellites, you know, our daily lives are entwined with things that happen in space, even when we are on Earth. And I was really struck by people who speak of orbit as a resource that we are not taking very good care of.
Yeah, you quote the archaeologist Alice Gorman here, who thinks we need to start thinking about space as an extension of the Earth's environment. What is that? What might that look like?
I mean, I think it's about not thinking about space as this big emptiness that there's plenty of room for and we can just go do whatever we want. We have finally started to wrap our heads around the idea on Earth that resources are finite, that what we do impacts the environment, which then impacts our lives, not to mention the lives of plants and animals and all the other life on Earth. And because there is no natural life in space, we tend to think of it as like a free-for-all. We're like, well, who are we going to hurt? But we have to recognize that we are hurting ourselves. And I also think that there's kind of an ethical way of thinking about it as well, which is even if there aren't plants and animals in space, not that that has stopped us from messing up various ecosystems on Earth, you know, what is an ethical way of expanding humanity off the Earth and taking our best ways of being rather than some of our worst?
Did we make a mistake by starting low Earth orbit so low? I mean, presumably, if we defined low Earth orbit as 1,000 miles from the surface of the Earth, there would be kind of exponentially more territory out there for these satellites to inhabit.
It's not really an arbitrary human definition in that way. It's that there is this zone in orbit where it's relatively easy to get satellites up there to keep them going, where they move very fast. Different areas of orbit are useful in different ways. So it's not that we created, you know, a highway and whoops, we put the highway in the wrong place. It's more that there, it's more like, you know, a pass through the mountains. And it's like, well, where else are you going to go? So I think just we call it low Earth orbit, but that is, you know, our designation of this zone of orbit that happens to be particularly useful in certain ways.
So has anyone proposed solutions to this problem of crowding in space?
I don't know that there are specific proposals, but the general need that I heard over and over again is regulation, is a sense of norms and conventions about how we treat orbit. You know, nations don't seem to do treaties much anymore, but I think some sort of agreement or the US government taking some sort of responsibility for what American companies are doing. Because, you know, orbit covers the whole Earth. So even though the FCC regulates launches by American companies, those satellites go over everyone's land. So more global cooperation would be very meaningful, but it could also really serve us to have a couple of larger nations stepping up and taking leadership and doing things in a more responsible way.
That makes perfect sense to me. I also realize that you might run into the problem of, you know, people rolling their eyes at lawmakers spending time on this, right? You know, I think about President Trump starting the Space Force, and a lot of people thought that was just a silly thing to do. Space is going to be more and more a part of our lives, even if we don't think we're affected by what's going on.
Absolutely. You know, I think that it is, it's really important. And I love all sorts of space research and talking about space, the distant stuff, the near stuff, but this is the closest part of space to our daily lives. And it's our lives are so intertwined with what happens in orbit, not just for, you know, inspiring research like the ISS, but our daily lives. And I think that it is really important. It's probably more important than some other things that get a lot of time in Congress. So I hope that someone will be brave enough to take it up.
There has been such an effect on our vision of what space exploration can be from science fiction. Is there any science fiction you've come across that even notes the problem of space junk?
That's a really interesting question. None that comes to mind. I'm thinking a little bit of the Neal Stephenson novel, Seven Eves. And there is a thing going on there where there's the ISS and a bunch of small spacecraft in orbit. And they are having to dodge collisions, but I can't remember if it's with space junk or with basically the moon has blown up in that book. And so I don't remember if it's bits of moon or other things in orbit. It's a really good book, though.
So how much do astronomers worry about this stuff? Is it something that for now, a lot? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's especially all of it. I think especially with the rapid increase of satellite launches coming from SpaceX and now other companies trying to follow their lead with these satellite mega constellations, as they're called, there is real concern. Some people think that we are already in Kessler syndrome and that it's moving slowly, but that collisions are going to keep increasing and increasing. Other people think we're right on the edge. And like orbit could become unusable for centuries if things go wrong. And then there's the concern for ground-based astronomy. This is something that I think astronomers feel a little bit like Chicken Little about, where they're like, this is really, really bad. And we are right on the edge of losing the night sky as a scientific resource, a cultural resource, and orbit as a zone of human work for scientific research, I guess military stuff, if you care about that, for business. It is really under threat.
So, Jamie, with all of this space debris out there, presumably missions containing human beings could run into this stuff. Are NASA and the other space organizations on the planet that send humans into space able to know where space debris might be when they send a mission up?
Yeah, every piece of space debris that's bigger than like a baseball or a softball or so is being actively tracked. And so the ISS has onboard boosters to slightly adjust course. It has to do that often anyway to stay in orbit and not get pulled back down to Earth. And so sometimes there are course adjustments to avoid something. That is obviously the highest priority when there are people on there. So yes, it is a concern and it is part of what has to be done to keep those missions safe.
Are companies, SpaceX, I know, just had a failed launch. I don't think it was related to this, but I wonder if this is already happening when new spacecraft and satellites are launched. Are those launches ever sort of destroyed right away by a collision with space junk?
I don't believe that that's happened. I don't think that that has happened yet, but it's certainly not impossible. The bigger concern right now, though, is bodies in orbit hitting each other rather than a satellite on its or a rocket on its way up.
So I mentioned earlier that, you know, some people might scoff at the idea of governments coming together to make treaties about satellite orbits. What about private companies in concert with one another? Is there a lot of talk about cooperation or deals made among people who are launching large numbers of satellites?
No, there's absolutely none. It's very each corporation for itself, because the goal is profit. And it's, you know, you said earlier that it seems a lot like the Wild West. I think it is really a lot like American expansion into the West. I think it's a lot like, you know, everything that our society has done when it has found a new unspoiled bit of earth is to go and spoil it and squeeze it for all it's worth and make the money that we can and then say, oh, whoops, it's terrible now. And we're just replaying. I'm sorry, this is such a pessimistic point of view, but it is, because like the corporations don't care about preserving orbit. They care about getting their satellites up and making their profits. And so I think that's why the responsibility really falls on the government, because that's what governments are supposed to do. They're supposed to have their people's best interests in mind and, I don't know, like make the hard decisions. And that just isn't happening.
Yeah, I also think about, you know, governments of wealthier countries that have more developed space, commercial space industries, gaining this great advantage over companies that countries that may be able to get there but aren't there yet. It feels like there ought to be some limitations based on that, just so that the access to space is equitably distributed.
I agree. I don't know. Yes, it should. It should. It's a lot of should.
Can you think, if you were in charge of this and given a little more time to do some research, Jamie, what changes would you make to current policies regarding space junk? Like, or what policies need to be put in place?
I would stop giving SpaceX licenses to launch at all. I think, because one of the things that's most irritating about SpaceX, aside from just the huge quantity of satellites being launched, is there are other ways to get internet to remote areas. I feel like they're using satellites and they are using space because space is cool, but it's sort of, you know, not the most efficient, least harmful, least resource abusing way to do it. And so I think that there could be a lot more care taken in thinking about what projects need to be in orbit, what research needs to be in orbit, and what could be accomplished with a tiny bit of creativity or other kinds of thinking still on Earth. I don't know how much actual regulating is happening about launches. I feel like they're more tracked than decided about. And I just think that letting the profit-seeking corporations take the lead means that the values other than profit fall by the wayside.
Is there broad agreement among scientists about best practices for minimizing the amount of space trash we generate?
Yeah, number one is launch fewer satellites. Like, mm-hmm. that is by far, we are launching way more than is currently up there. So I think, and also like what's up there, what's still up there of the defunct stuff, if it's been there for decades, it's probably safe. It's sort of like that thing with airplanes in World War II, where airplanes would come back after bombing missions and they would have gunshot holes in certain spots. And so they started protecting those areas of the planes, but it wasn't working because they realized that if a plane could return with gunshots on those spots, those weren't the vulnerable spots. And so right. You had to actually protect the other parts of the airplane. Similar with, I guess it's kind of similar with the satellites, something that is up there from 30 years ago is probably not a threat. Adding a bunch of new satellites, a bunch of new variables into this whole complex system in orbit, that is by far the biggest threat and the biggest danger and what needs to be scaled back.
Jamie Green is the series editor of The Best American Science and Nature Writing and author of The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Her article about space junk was titled Befouling the Final Frontier and appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Jamie, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. And if you want the podcast, you can subscribe for free wherever you like to get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Or listen anytime right at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.